some speculation, oh, it's the World Cup driving up leisure and hospitality. Actually, no, we didn't really see much of a boost there.
Disappointing news from the Labor Department, a second month in a row where the jobs report came in weaker than expected.
It's Friday, August 7th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ahead, President Trump is increasingly confronting a question that's haunted past presidents: how a war that has gone on longer than predicted can reshape a presidency.
Also, a new series from NPR's embedded podcast, The Seattle Times, and KUOW about the unsolved killing of a black teenager.
You know, anything that anybody will ever tell you that knew my son, he's respectable, he's caring, and he's supportive.
And with about 1 month left of summer, we ask, have you done all the things you wanted?
We ask our staff that very question after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump's embattled nominee for attorney general will likely squeak by in his Senate confirmation. As NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports, Todd Blanche is getting key support from Louisiana Republican Senator Bill Cassidy.
Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche has been facing an increasingly uphill battle in his Senate confirmation. Republican Senators Lisa Murkowski of Alaska and Susan Collins of Maine both are opposing his nomination, which meant all eyes were on Senator Cassidy of Louisiana. Cassidy said he had concerns over Blanche's judgment and how politicized the department has become, but ultimately said he'll support him.
The choice is not between perfection and Mr. Blanche. It is between Mr. Blanche and another acting attorney general who may not run the department effectively under President Trump and who indeed may not be as good as Mr. Blanche.
Cassidy's support gives Blanche the votes he'll need for confirmation and is a major win for the White House. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
The wait continues for a Supreme Court ruling on whether the Trump administration can resume carrying out key parts of the president's executive order to limit voting by mail in the midterm election. NPR's Hanzila Wang reports another ruling on Trump's order may come soon from a lower court.
A federal judge in Boston is considering a request to block the U.S. Postal Service from carrying out President Trump's directives across the country. American Civil Liberties Union's Sophia Lynn Lakin helped file the request.
Changing the rules of the game at this point in time in such a significant manner does nothing to ensure confidence in the election this November and would only create chaos and confusion for voters.
Trump's order calls for USPS, which is a financial supporter of NPR, to get lists of eligible voters from states and deliver mail and ballots only to people on those lists. The president has said he issued this order to stop illegal voting by non-U.S. citizens, a problem that many studies have found to be extremely rare. The Supreme Court is now considering Trump's request to pause an earlier ruling that blocks implementation of the policy in the 23 states plus Washington, D.C. that sued over the order. Anzila Wong, NPR News.
A federal appeals court has blocked construction on the White House ballroom, saying Congress needs to give the green light. NPR's Rachel Treisman has more.
A three-judge panel Friday ruled that building a White House ballroom is a question for Congress, not, quote, a matter for executive self-help. That's a win for the historic preservation nonprofit that sued the administration back in December after it demolished the east wing of the White House to build a $400 million ballroom. The ruling halts further above-ground construction, but does not take effect for 2 weeks to give the Trump administration time to appeal the decision to the Supreme Court. President Trump immediately said that it will. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
Crude oil prices lower by the close. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Senate passed a Russian sanctions bill that was a top priority for the late Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. The bipartisan legislation would penalize countries that continue to buy Russian oil, gas, and other exports, and it allows President Trump to impose tariffs on the world's top five buyers of Moscow's oil or natural gas. It's meant to stifle Russia's economy. This bill now heads to the House of Representatives. The United Nations agency says, Children's Agency says at least 300 children have been reported killed in Gaza since a ceasefire was signed nearly a year ago. NPR's Jane Araf reports that's an average of one child a day.
Israel agreed last October to suspend military operations and allow in more food and medicine in the agreement with Hamas. UNICEF said the ceasefire was failing children and noted that hundreds more children had been injured. The Israeli military is now occupying more of the Gaza Strip, with families crowded into roughly a third of the territory without adequate clean water or waste facilities. UNICEF said children there continue to face acute malnutrition and disease. A UN commission in June found that Israel had deliberately killed Palestinian children throughout the war in Gaza and said Israel continued to fail to protect children after the ceasefire. Israel rejected the findings. Jane Araf, NPR News.
Wall Street higher by the closing bell, the Dow up 151 points, NASDAQ up 342. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing real stories with supporting data through its podcast, After the Fact, exploring how people find solutions to some of today's biggest issues. This is NPR.
Good afternoon, it's 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on People Powered KAXC. Coming up, an update on jobs in the month of July. Weather for our evening, mostly clear with lows 50 to 54. Sunny tomorrow, highs in the mid-70s to low 80s, with showers and thunderstorms moving in tomorrow night. I'm Heidi Holt, and hope you have a good Friday afternoon.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. The U.S. job market is suffering a summer slowdown. A report from the Labor Department this morning shows employers cut more than 20,000 jobs in July. That's sobering news at a time when polls show many Americans are already feeling gloomy about the economy. NPR Scott Horsley joins us. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Isn't this the second month in a row that the jobs report has been weaker than expected?
Yeah, it is. So a market that was already sluggish has now shifted into reverse. Retailers and insurance companies cut jobs last month. Even healthcare, which had been a reliable source of job growth, saw weaker hiring in July than earlier in the year. Some of the losses at public schools might have been exaggerated by seasonal adjustments, but make no mistake, this was a weak report. Economist Corey Contenga of LinkedIn says even bars and restaurants, which hoped to get a kick from the big soccer tournament this summer, instead wound up losing 26,000 jobs last month.
There was some speculation, oh, it's the World Cup driving up leisure and hospitality. Actually, no, we didn't really see much of a boost there. We are still facing a labor market where hiring is over 20% slower than what we saw prior to the pandemic.
And the weakness was not limited to July. More complete numbers from May and June also erased more than 100,000 jobs we thought were added during those 2 months.
But help me square these two things, because the unemployment rate is also really low. How can those two things both be true?
Yeah, the unemployment rate is low, just 4.1% last month, and it actually inched down, but that's not as good as it sounds. The rate is not falling because people are finding jobs. It's falling because more than 250,000 people gave up and dropped out of the workforce last month. Now, some of that is to be expected as baby boomers age and retire, but the number of working age people in the labor market has also shrunk by about 600,000 since the beginning of the year. Contenga says for some people, work is just not paying enough these days to justify the cost of filling your gas tank or hiring a babysitter.
Partly it might have to do with the fact that real wages today are going down. It's not as good of a deal to work when inflation outpaces your wage gains. You don't necessarily gain by working.
Average wages in July were up just 3.2% from a year ago. That's probably not enough to keep pace with the rising cost of living. We'll find out for sure next week when we get the July inflation data.
Stay with inflation, which the Federal Reserve, of course, keeps promising to bring under control. How does this jobs report today affect the Fed's calculation there?
Well, the Fed's balancing act is getting tougher. Ordinarily, the central bank would raise interest rates to fight inflation and cut rates to boost the job market. A week ago, investors were betting the Fed would raise rates at its next meeting in September. Today's downbeat jobs report makes that a much closer call.
Scott, one more piece of Fed news to talk through today, and that is we're told President Trump is trying again to remove Fed Governor Lisa Cook.
Yeah, it was just over a month ago the Supreme Court smacked down the president in his effort to fire Cook over unproven allegations of mortgage fraud. But Trump is not giving up. The White House is now demanding that Cook respond to mortgage allegations. Cook's lawyer insists the charges are baseless and is promising to fight Trump's effort in court. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, the top Democrat on the committee that oversees the Fed, said in a statement today, Donald Trump is tanking the economy and desperate to shift the blame. And Warren is also promising to fight this renewed effort by the White House to fire Cook.
Thank you, Scott.
You're welcome.
And Pierre Scott Horsley.
For decades, Israeli Jewish settlers have been building settlements in the occupied West Bank. And now, ahead of an October election that could remove it from power, Israel's right-wing government is greenlighting settlement expansion. It's also approving new settlements, including some in areas that are supposed to be under Palestinian political control. The result? Palestinian residents say that they are now encircled and besieged by violent settlers. NPR's Emily Feng reports.
We meet Luai Adele building a cinder block wall around his house. He said he went into debt to build it. But I need the wall to protect my family from settlers and from the Israeli army, he says. From their house, they look directly across a small valley to the next hill, where Jewish settlers have built the outpost of Eviatar, which was recently legalized by the Israeli government. Living next to Eviatar is like living on the front lines of a war, his wife Najat says. Because, she says, there's no security. Every few days, she says, she discovers a vegetable garden ripped up or a tree chopped down. The settlers come and destroy everything, she says. This brutal test of opposing wills, settler versus Palestinian, has literally changed the landscape here in the Palestinian town of Beita. The village is in what is known as Area B, land under Palestinian civil administration, but Israel's security control. Ahmed Dwaykat, another resident, reminisces when the hills here were covered with olive trees and plants that were green and flowering. But now there's nothing here, he says. The fields around us are yellow with weeds and barren, abandoned by the two Palestinian families who simply moved away under pressure from Eviatar settlers. Dwaykat points out a chain of four settlements on the ridge surrounding his town, all expanding since the start of the Gaza War in October 2023, forming a chain of Israeli communities that rings Beita. And that is paralyzing the local economy. Here in this local market, rotting melon rinds and cardboard boxes are underfoot because an Israeli settlement cut off the market's access to the local dump. And Serhan Ali Kanan, a wholesaler here, says more and more of the produce has to be imported from Israel because the settlers forbid us to plant. They cut off our water and they destroy our greenhouses, he says. The Israeli military says the number of what they call nationalistic crime incidents, their term for settler violence, rose to 120 in 2025, an increase of about 45% from 2024. The Israeli military, police, and intelligence say they've started a joint task force to combat this violence. But in July, 600 retired Israeli security officials signed a letter pleading for U.S. President Trump to further pressure Israel's leaders to end what they called settler terror in the West Bank. The letter came after a deadly July clash between settlers and Palestinians and after arsonists in the West Bank village of Kusra, also in Area B, partially burned down a mosque. Israel's military condemned this act and said it was investigating. And I can smell the burnt mosque even before I see it. But Mohammed Al-Haj Ahmed says the incident is part of a pattern. Using a soot-stained hand, he points to three Israeli settlements in view through one of the mosque windows and explains how he used to sneak food and water to a Palestinian home some 150 yards in front of us. Some settlers set up a tent right next to the house this year, locking the family in their own home for 3 months. But they fled 2 weeks ago, Al-Haj Ahmed says, after their water and power lines were also cut by the settlers. That's the goal of these Israeli settlers, activists such as the Israeli group Peace Now say, to push out Palestinian occupants and take de facto control of the land, thereby disrupting any possibility of a future Palestinian state. And the months before Israel's elections this October, Israel's right-wing government has approved a flurry of new and expanded settlements before a new government could potentially pause them. The rise in settler attacks has prompted many rural Palestinian communities to organize night watches.
Y'all love it.
Shepherd Kusai Abu Al-Kabash welcomes us outside his watch tent with coffee. He stays up until at least 3 a.m. every morning. He knows from experience that the worst attacks come after midnight. From a group of settlers so persistent and aggressive, Abu Al-Kabash knows all of them by name. The 29-year-old describes how this past March they stripped him, beat him and his family, and zip-tied his genitals, moments captured by his security cameras. But all he can think about now are the nearly 400 sheep the settlers stole, a flock accumulated over two generations and his entire extended family's fortune. His father, Ibrahim Abu Al-Kabash, listens to his son in a daze, as if he still cannot believe the tragedy that has befallen them. He slowly unwraps his headscarf in the moonlight to show where the settlers battered him. But it's the sheep that he, too, is worried about. He keeps repeating, we must get them back. Down a pitted dirt road, the Basharat family are also still wide awake at midnight. Their patriarch, Yusuf Basharat, shifts positions on a makeshift mattress every few seconds from pain. After being beaten last November by settlers, he says he's dislocated something in his back, and yet he keeps watch. The entire family takes two-hour shifts through the night, every night, he explains, beginning after settlers stole a horse from them last year. And when we see settlers, the first thing we do is we get our phones to film them, and we prepare stones to throw, says Najat Basharat, his wife, even though the settlers are often armed with guns. Seven other Palestinian families around them have already left because of the settlers. And our turn is coming, she says. But I know every tree and every stone here, she says, her voice rising. How can the settlers say they are forbidden to me? Emily Fang, NPR News, Machul, the West Bank.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 4:18. Coming up, we've got our Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer. You've been listening to the news of the afternoon here on People Powered KAXC. Support comes from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursdays starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. If you missed this week's full Phenology report, you can catch it right now at kaxe.org.
On today's date, August 7th, 1989, I discover a patch of closed gentians. Closed gentians are flowers, and they, at least the ones I've found, are found growing along riverbanks and along the banks of the Prairie Lake. And all the ones I've seen have been within a dozen or 2 feet of water. So they're not far removed from water when I find them. But the interesting thing is that this flower never really opens up. It's always closed, hence the name. And it was thought for a long time that this might be one of those clistogamous flowers. Clistogamous means closed marriage, and by not opening up, it would be self-pollinating. But careful observation has shown that these flowers actually are opened by bumblebees who simply force their way in between the petals and gather the nectar and spread the pollen around. And so that's how the closed gentian gets pollination accomplished.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, made with psyllium, a plant-based fiber that helps support digestive health by trapping and removing waste, designed to be taken every day. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' interest. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A new series from NPR's embedded podcast, The Seattle Times and KUOW, investigates the unsolved killing of a Black teenager from Southern California. Antonio Mays Jr. was just 16 years old when he joined the Black Lives Matter protest in Seattle in 2020. A week after arriving there, he was shot dead. The series, called We Keep Us Safe, uncovers new evidence and talks with key eyewitnesses who challenge the dominant narrative about Antonio's killing. We're joined now by two reporters on the series, Sydney Brownstone from the Seattle Times and Will James from KUOW. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
So in the wake of George Floyd's killing in 2020, Black Lives Matter protests spread across the country. We all remember these images. But the protest in Seattle was different, right? It got a lot of media attention at the time. Can you just remind listeners what was going on there?
So in Seattle, a really intense standoff between protesters and police formed outside a particular precinct. And police ended up walking away from the precinct, just abandoning the building.
The police are now moving out. The street is going to open up.
Protesters then established a self-governed police-free zone in about 8 blocks surrounding the precinct called the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest, or CHOP for short. And for a little while, it was idealistic and utopian. There were no police there. There were people giving out free food. But by the time Antonio arrived a couple weeks in, things had devolved. A lot of people had shown up to just party. There were reports of gangs. There were drugs. There was crime. Protesters had set up kind of self-styled security groups. A lot of them were armed to defend against right-wing attacks. And while this was a Black Lives Matter protest, a lot of these security volunteers were white.
Interesting. And then 3 weeks into CHOP, as it was called, there was a shooting and Antonio Mays Jr. was killed. Sydney, I know that you were on the ground reporting just hours after that happened. What were you hearing at the time?
The protesters who were there overnight told me that they were attacked by a stolen white Jeep driving around erratically. There was shooting coming from the Jeep towards the protesters. Antonio and another teenager, a 14-year-old, were in that Jeep. And the story was that armed protest security fired back at them in self-defense. This shooting killed Antonio and wounded the other teenager. And the widely accepted narrative on the ground was that these teens were in a gang or doing a gang initiation, and that's why they were attacking the protest, and that's why they were killed.
That was the widely accepted narrative, but what did your investigation find out about that version?
For years, pretty much everyone thought that there were only two kids in the Jeep that night, Antonio and the 14-year-old. But we discovered that there was actually a third teenager in the car. We are calling him DG. Those are his initials because he doesn't want to talk to law enforcement or get involved in a court case. And DG told us that the boys went for a joyride, that they were unarmed. And almost as soon as he got into the vehicle, another car started chasing them and shooting at them.
I'm laying there thinking I'm going to die. Like, you know, these bullets are like whizzing over my head and going through these seats.
Wow, sounds terrifying.
Yeah, and when we asked DG the hard question, did you have guns? Were you shooting? This is what he said.
We didn't have no guns. Three 16-year-old boys would have been shooting back at them if we had guns. Or just sitting ducks, getting literally just like hawked down.
And DG's account is supported by some new evidence. The city of Seattle hired a video analyst to go over a bunch of recordings from that night. And this analyst found multiple shots coming from multiple sources, but did not find any shots coming from the white Jeep that those teenagers were in. There were a couple of eyewitnesses, and one of them, Eric Diantino, says he saw someone walk up to this white Jeep after it had already crashed.
I see someone approach the passenger side of the Jeep Grand Cherokee, like really close, like point blank, and just unload his clip.
Okay, so a lot of discrepancies with the presiding narrative about what happened, but what else were you able to find out about who actually could have shot Antonio Mays Jr.?
We were able to see text messages from a Seattle city official and a police official that proved that they knew about a suspect who went by the name Steve, and they knew about him since 2020. Police tell us that in order to close this case, they need witnesses to come forward, and that means people who were there at the protest when the shooting happened. Apparently, so far, that hasn't happened.
But there are other reasons why this case may remain unsolved. Police did not immediately secure the scene. We were able to obtain body camera footage from police that shows a contingent of police officers approaching the crashed Jeep, and they see protesters milling around the Jeep, tampering with the crime scene, and they make the decision to leave that scene for hours until homicide detectives got there the following morning. So It's possible that important evidence was destroyed or tampered with.
Absolutely. Well, how do you feel your reporting has changed your understanding of Antonio and what happened at CHOP?
It raises the question, did protesters mimic the overuse of lethal force that they were critiquing that summer? Even some protesters we talked with 5 years later, 6 years later, kind of walked away with an understanding of that irony.
And what makes that irony even more tragic is that we learned, contrary to the story that Antonio may have had bad intentions, we learned that he really did come to CHOP to protest. He was there for the cause. This narrative that Antonio was up to no good, these gang allegations, it's something that really continues to affect his dad, Antonio Mays Sr., who's still left without answer and feels like he's the only person standing up for his son's memory. One of the things we were able to find in our investigation is a clip of Antonio speaking at CHOP in the days before he was killed, and we showed it to his dad.
The police, their purpose is to serve and protect, right?
Yes.
We asked him about what he thought of seeing his son on the video.
It's like a gift from God, just cracking the heavens wide open and letting the son come gaping through. He's speaking his own testimony right there. You know, anything that anybody will ever tell you that knew my son will tell you he is exactly that. He's respectable, he's caring, and he's supportive.
We get a much fuller picture of Antonio Mays Jr.'s life and where the culpability for his death lies in the full series.
That was Sydney Brownstone of the Seattle Times and Will James from KUOW. Thank you both so much for this reporting.
Thank you, Elsa.
We Keep Us Safe is a production of NPR's embedded podcast, The Seattle Times, and member station KUOW. All episodes are available now in the embedded feed.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29. Coming up, we've got National Native News here on KAXE. An hour from now, we bring you local news with the Up North Report. We receive support from Klocko Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer as well as modern classics for 8 years. Their taproom is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday, Saturday, noon to 8, and Sunday from noon to 6. More information at klockobrewing.com. Weather around our region, it looks like we'll have a mostly clear skies tonight, lows 50 to 54. Tomorrow, sunny with highs in the mid-70s to low 80s. West winds gusting up to 20. Overnight lows in the low 50s to low 60s with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. We receive support from Sanford Bemidji Family Medicine Team, providing care to the whole family from birth to the golden years. More at bemidji.sanfordhealth.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. The doors of what was once Kodiak's North Star Elementary School reopened on August 3rd for the first time since last June. The school closed because of budget cuts. But one wing of the building is now home to the Shunack Tribe's Aleutianshut Child Care Center, a preschool for 2 to 5-year-olds. KMXT's Catherine Irving toured the center before its opening and has the story.
This is our Fox's classroom. This is our oldest.
Montana Sanchez is the child care administrator for the Shunack Tribe. On a Friday at the end of July, the building that used to be North Star Elementary School was abuzz with activity.
You just walk into fixing the ceilings and the Wi-Fi on the same day, so.
Sanchez and the teachers had just 3 days left to get everything finished before opening their doors for preschoolers on August 3rd.
I think everyone's been here for the last 3 weekends in a row getting this set up.
The tribe's Aleutianshut Child Care Center got its start in 2022 with one classroom at St. Mary's Catholic Church. The center has always accepted all children ages 2 to 5, but has a preference for Alaska Native and American Indian families. As demand grew, they expanded to 3 classrooms at St. Mary's. With a long wait list and no more room to grow at the parish, Sanchez says moving to the North Star building was the logical next step. Sadie Coyle, or Miss Taku as the kids call her, is the Aleutic language teacher for the preschool, and she's been with the Aleutianshut Child Care Center since the beginning.
Because when we first started, four years ago, we had 1 classroom, and now eventually we're going to have 5. I think that's a good milestone for us.
Sanchez says they currently have 35 preschoolers enrolled. They're planning to enroll 75 kids by December, and they're hoping to be licensed for a maximum of 110 by next year.
We're going to take it slow. And then hopefully in another month and a half, we'll open another classroom, and after that, another classroom.
Even with the expansion, Sanchez says they still have people on their wait list. There are several in-home daycares on the island, but the Tribes is the only child care center, besides the one on Coast Guard Base Kodiak, which isn't accessible to the general public. She says child care is hard to come by.
Especially the ages from 3 to 5, it's such a hard age to find child care for. But yeah, we're really hoping to kind of fill that need.
The expansion to North Star brings new opportunities. Coyle, the language teacher, says she's excited to finally have her own classroom with the space to teach the kids Aleutic dances.
Dancing is my passion, and I want to be able to teach them dances that I've learned, you know, for the last 15 years now. They have a lot more fun singing and learning, and like adding a little bit of song and tune to the language helps a lot.
Coyle says she's been designing the curriculum from her class from scratch, which has been a lot of work and no small amount of stress. But she says it's all been worth it.
A couple weeks ago, one of my kiddos looked outside, and it was very sunny. And he said, "Oh, Miss Taku, it's Majangok out." And like those little moments where I'm like, oh, I'm doing something right. I'm doing something for the community.
After months of work and 4 weekends spent getting everything ready, the North Star Wing opened for childcare on August 3rd. Sanchez says kids and parents alike were excited to explore the new space. Reporting in Kodiak, I'm Catherine Irving.
A federal appeals court is siding with the Wisconsin tribe in its long-running fight against an oil pipeline crossing its reservation. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals ruled Enbridge has been trespassing on land belonging to the Bad River Band of the Lake Superior Chippewa after pipeline easements on some tribal lands expired in 2013. The court says Enbridge must remove its Line 5 pipeline from those lands, but sent the case to a lower court to reconsider how much time the company will have to complete a reroute. The court will also reconsider how much Enbridge owes the tribe for profits connected to the trespass. I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Colorado Plateau Foundation, supporting Native-led initiatives protecting plateau lands, waters, and cultures by building networks, community, and organizational capacity. Grant proposals accepted only through August 14th at ColoradoPlateauFoundation.org.
Hear that? Tribal college faculty do so much, one can't say it all here. Nothing but respect. Visit mostthoroughjobdescription.com. The American Indian College Fund supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, which has generated over $1.75 million to support NPR programming. Learn more at nprwineclub.org, available to adults 21 or older. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil, made with psyllium, a plant-based fiber that helps support digestive health by trapping and removing waste, designed to be taken every day. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from the Wallace Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The Senate sprung into action today with a flurry of votes ahead of an extended August recess. Republicans in the chamber have been trying to make progress on several key priorities, but they have also struggled to make headway on voting legislation that President Trump has been pressuring them to pass for months. Joining us now to talk about all of this is NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales. Hi, Claudia.
Hey, Elsa.
Hey. Okay, so the Senate has been working through quite a logjam today. What have they gotten done so far?
Well, they got one big, very rare thing done. They'd approved a Russia sanctions bill with broad bipartisan support in a vote of 87 to 11.
Okay.
This was at least a year in the works, and it was named for the late GOP Senator Lindsey Graham, who really led the push on this bill for about a year, all the way up to his death last month.
Right.
And the bill is designed to really squeeze the Russian economy. And the way it would do that is by letting President Trump place tariffs on countries that buy Russian oil and natural gas, some tariffs as high as 100%. The bill's supporters saw this as a tribute to Graham, this legislation, and his death added momentum to the push to get it done. Here's his sister, Darlene Graham, right before the vote. She was appointed to serve the remainder of his term.
My late brother Lindsey was a foreign policy and national security expert. He was also a peacemaker who was determined to bring an end to the conflict in Ukraine.
Well, when do we expect this bill to reach President Trump's desk?
Well, first it needs to go to the House, which is currently on their August recess. Speaker Mike Johnson has signaled support for the bill, but we should note that some Democrats have raised concerns about giving Trump more power to place tariffs on other countries.
Okay, Russia sanctions, check. What else are senators trying to get done before leaving town?
Well, two big things. The first is a stopgap funding measure to hopefully avoid a government shutdown after Congress gets back in September. The bill would extend that funding past the midterms. Republicans also want to confirm Attorney General nominee Todd Blanche. That nomination has taken up a lot of oxygen this week because until today, it wasn't clear if he had the votes to win confirmation.
Right. I mean, this confirmation process for Blanche has been tumultuous all week long.
Yes, it really has been. We started the morning with an announcement from Alaska Republican Lisa Murkowski saying she would not vote for him over concerns Blanche would not push back against all of Trump's demands. And from there, all eyes were on another swing vote. This is Bill Cassidy from Louisiana, and he took to the Senate floor and talked about his concern over Blanche's role in things like the $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund.
Mr. Blanche is not perfect, and he will tell you this, but the choice is not between perfection and Mr. Blanche. It is between Mr. Blanche and another acting attorney general who may not run the department effectively under President Trump.
So he actually argued that in the end, he'd vote for Blanche because Blanche would have more leverage to work independently from Trump's demands if he is confirmed.
Mm. Okay, well, one last question. What about the Save America Act? Because President Trump said that he didn't think the Senate should even leave until they pass it. What is the latest on that?
Yeah, that's been a big sore spot between Trump and Senate Majority Leader John Thune. As a reminder, this is legislation that would require voters to show proof of citizenship, voter ID, before they can cast a ballot.
Right.
And Trump wanted the Senate to stay in through the month of August to get this done. But Thune has been very consistent. The votes just are not there. And that's even after trying to attach a version of this to a GOP budget plan that would include funding for the Pentagon. So this is a fight that might continue to play out even after recess is over.
That is NPR's Claudia Grisales. Thank you so much, Claudia.
Thank you.
President Trump is increasingly confronting a question that has haunted other presidents: how a war that goes on longer than predicted can reshape a presidency. President Trump has acknowledged he's trying to avoid the pitfalls of one of his predecessors, Herbert Hoover, the Republican whose name became synonymous with the economic collapse of the Great Depression.
So rather than possibly going into a depression, rather than having your favorite president be Herbert Hoover, I was always the one I didn't want to be.
Those concerns were reflected when he signed the short-lived peace agreement with Iran in June. Evidence, perhaps, that the president is thinking beyond military objectives and understanding he may ultimately be judged not by what happens in combat, but by how it affects inflation, gas prices, and people's lives at home. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez reports.
Thank you. At the G7 summit in France, President Trump shared what has been a long-standing fear of being compared to Hoover, something he's raised repeatedly over the years.
And you know, I've studied presidents, some good, some bad, some great. Not too many are great, and some really bad. We had one just recently. And the one president I did not want to be was the late, great Herbert Hoover. I didn't want that. And who knows what would have happened.
Those comments were more than an offhand remark. Instead, they reveal his sensibilities of what it means to be a good president and how he hopes to be remembered by history.
I think that Trump often reveals what he's thinking in these comments he makes. They sound like asides, but I think they are indicative of his upbringing, and he grew up in a period where Herbert Hoover was a very negative thing to be.
Tevi Troy, a presidential historian and former White House aide to George W. Bush, says Trump, born in 1946, grew up during a time when Hoover served as a cautionary example of what not to do during difficult economic times. Hoover stuck to his Republican principles that the government shouldn't meddle in the economy, a decision that many saw as one of the worst political mistakes of the 20th century.
And he clearly does not want to be Herbert Hoover, and he's not the only Republican president who had that fear.
During the financial crisis of 2008, President George W. Bush urged Congress to approve his plan to stabilize the financial markets, arguing that it was better to take action or risk being compared to Herbert Hoover. Ronald Reagan also faced Hoover comparisons during the recession of 1981 and 1982, but escaped that association when the economy rebounded.
Any Republican president who gets hit with bad economic times faces the danger of being tagged as Herbert Hoover. You don't really hear people saying that Jimmy Carter was Herbert Hoover, even though he had a poor economic record and the economy wasn't doing well. It's constantly something that happens to Republican presidents, not Democrats.
For Trump, the concern is more urgent as the war in Iran takes its toll on energy markets and inflation.
First of all, you know, risks of recession are higher today than they were prior to the war.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at the accounting firm KPMG, says the risks are not off the charts, but that the concern grows higher the longer that inflation persists, and the Federal Reserve leaves it unaddressed. Still, she cautions against treating today's economy as a replay of Hoover's experience, noting the economy was much different then and that there are better tools today to prevent such a catastrophe.
It's hard to get back to a Hoover-type situation. There were so many policy mistakes made back then that caused that situation and how it played out.
But the president has long understood that his political success may be defined by the performance of the economy. And he knows that a prolonged war can often reshape a presidency in unexpected ways. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
News headlines from the state of Minnesota coming up next on North Star Stories. I'm Heidi Holton. It's 4:44. We'd like to thank North Homes Children and Family Services for their support. They provide compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. And thanks also to ICTV, streaming news and information for and about Itasca County at watchictv.org. Next Tuesday is primary day, primary voting. It's actually open right now, but you can find out more information about who's running for office locally, statewide, federal offices. We've got primary election guides for the counties of northern Minnesota available for free, kaxc.org, and there are printable versions there of it as well. Please share with your friends and neighbors. Lows tonight from 50 to 54 degrees.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
With headlines from around the state, I'm Zan Holston. Students at a Western Minnesota high school are planning to answer a ban on rainbow displays with more rainbows. And a South Minneapolis community hub celebrates its 60th. But first, a proposed right-to-repair law for St. Paul renters will not go before voters this fall, even after supporters clear the required signature threshold. The measure would have allowed tenants to make certain repairs and deduct the cost from their rent when landlords fail to fix problems. The City Council voted 5-2 against putting the right-to-repair measure on the November ballot after city attorneys warned the proposal conflicted with state law and might not be enforceable. Councilmember Anika Bowie had endorsed the measure, but says that legal warning changed her vote.
It's not just a matter of putting a ballot initiative on the ballot. It's a matter of making sure that what you're putting on the ballot, if passes, can be actually enforceable as you intended, so we aren't setting voters up for failure.
The group behind the ballot question, Safe Home St. Paul, says volunteers collected more than enough verified signatures to meet the city's requirement for a ballot question. The group says the city charter required the council to either pass the ordinance as written or send it to voters. In Mankato, college enrollment remains near historic highs, but Minnesota State is cutting 53 positions as the university tries to close a $22 million two-year budget gap. 17 current faculty and staff positions will be eliminated through layoffs or other job cuts. The university is also eliminating 15 vacant positions and cutting 21 graduate assistants' jobs, while other employees have accepted early separation packages. In Rochester, an elementary school will stop teaching students despite months of objections from families. The school board unanimously approved a nearly $45 million facilities plan that will close Churchill Elementary School. Beginning in fall of next year, Churchill's kindergarten through second grade students will move to Hoover Elementary School. Board member Jean Marvin, who raised three children in Rochester schools, says she understands why families are upset.
They went to three different high schools, and it's emotional. You grow connected to the school your child is going to.
Churchill will be repurposed for alternative learning and independent living programs. Another Minnesota school board decision is resulting in an organized first day response from students. In Detroit Lakes in far western Minnesota near Moorhead, the board voted 4-2 to order the removal of materials not funded, sponsored, or authorized by the district. The motion specifically named rainbow stickers, posters, flags, and buttons. Board member Sanford Nelson introduced the motion, even though it was not on the published agenda. Superintendent Mark Jensen told the Minnesota Star Tribune that he and two board members were blindsided. Board supporters called the directive politically neutral, but students and staff told Valley News Live they had no opportunity to give input, and high school senior Molly Joe says she feels the decision makes other students feel small and isolated. She says students will hand out rainbow items when classes resume in September. The district has not yet posted the meeting minutes or the new policy. More than 200,000 Minnesotans could face new work requirements to keep their Medicaid coverage. The state is asking enrollees to prepare through its new online tool. Beginning January 1st, new federal work rules will generally apply to adults between 21 and 64 years old who do not live with dependent children, are not pregnant, and do not receive medical assistance based on disability. The new state renewal lookup tool allows enrollees to report expected work, school, and volunteer hours, or claim an exemption. The online tool is available through August 31st at mnrenewallookup.com. And finally, one of Minnesota's oldest black-founded nonprofits is throwing itself a 60th birthday party. For six decades, Sabathany Community Center has helped keep South Minneapolis fed, housed, and connected. Saturday, it celebrates with a free block party and a community march honoring two women who helped shape the South Side: Clarissa Walker, who built Sabathany's Family Resource Program, and Lana Q. Newman, who published the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder. The party includes barbecue, family activities, and music from Sounds of Blackness. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
North Star Stories is produced by Amherst, Minnesota's community radio stations, with support from the state of Minnesota, online at amherst.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
All right, time now for a summer progress report. Labor Day is only a month away, the unofficial finish line for summer, right?
Among our many to-do lists for the season were the books we set out to read, the projects we were absolutely, definitely going to tackle. So we wandered around NPR headquarters with one simple question.
What summer activity did you tell yourself you were going to do this summer that you have not yet done?
Oh, man. I said I was going to make so much ice cream, and I have a whole list of like summer-specific flavors. Have I even gone to the farmer's market and bought peaches for the peach ice cream I want to make? No.
Some of us had goals to dive into books.
One specific book that I started at the beginning of last year, and I told myself I'm giving myself till the end of the summer to finish it.
I made it a goal because I'm a big nerd who likes books about old boats.
Well, many of us, and this is me hand raising, we had planned to dive this summer into some water.
I wanted to go to the beach. I haven't been to the beach yet.
I really would have liked to visit more bodies of water.
I did say I was gonna like swim more, and I specifically got a certain hairstyle so I could swim for the 3 months of summer.
Not a river, not a swimming pool, not an ocean, not a sea. Just show me a puddle, I'll jump into it just to do it. I don't know. Got to figure it out before the summer ends.
No shame in staying dry. Well, exactly when summer ends depends on who you ask. Meteorologists call it at the end of August. Astronomers wait for the autumn equinox in September.
However you count the days, the window for summer plans, it's starting to close.
Not everyone is racing to fit one more thing into this summer. For a few people, the season went exactly as planned.
I did everything that I wanted to do this summer in June. I got to go home to New Mexico and swim and be outside and enjoy the sunshine. And I've done everything. And now I'm just waiting for the summer to be over for it to be fall.
Cue the writing of to-do lists for back-to-school shopping, jumping into piles of raked leaves. Ooh, Elsa, fall football.
And a shout out to our amazing producers, whom you just heard from: Gabriel Sanchez, Mallory Yu, Henry Larson, Michelle Aslam.
Also, Jeffrey Pierre, Vincent Accavino, Jordan Marie Smith, Daniel Offman, and Elena Burnett. Boythrob is an unconventional boy band. They have four members and one central problem.
Evan.
Zach. Anthony.
I'm Darshan. I'm stuck in India.
Boythrob.
Four boys, one band.
They've spent the last year establishing themselves while campaigning to get one member the visa he needs to join the other three in the U.S. This week, they made a big announcement on that front. NPR's Fio Guerin reports.
If you want to build a boy band, where do you start? Anthony Key says he and his co-founder looked to Instagram.
We came across Darshan, and we realized that, you know, he can hit high harmonies.
But I just, like, love hitting high notes.
That's Darshan Makhdoom. He had been putting out covers from Mumbai, India, when he got an interesting DM.
Saying, hey, Darshan, like, we are just doing something new. And at first, I was like, okay, this seems like something different.
Boythrob does operate somewhat differently from other bands, because Makhdoom initially didn't have a visa to perform in the U.S., so he'd record and appear with them remotely.
We're the world's next biggest boy band.
In their TikToks, his head pops into the videos randomly.
Send this to 1 million people.
either to send a message about his immigration status.
We need 1 million followers for me to get a visa so I can sing and dance in America.
Or to hit a high note wearing the band's signature hot pink tracksuit. The band educated their fans about the visa application process.
Here's all that goes into a visa application.
And they really leaned into the mission.
Day one of dancing outside the immigration office, trying to get the fourth member of our boy band out of India and into America so we can win a Grammy.
It's almost like the opposite of how it always happens.
That's Boythrob's immigration lawyer, Jonathan Grode. Because Boythrob started getting popular on TikTok before they put out any original music, he says their visa application was different from what the government is used to seeing.
They were changing the orientation of the way fame is formed and in exchange, how extraordinary ability can be proven to the government.
They needed to prove extraordinary ability to qualify for an O-1B work visa, which is designed specifically for artists and entertainers. Grode said he was eager to take on this case to push the boundaries of immigration law at a time when the law is being strictly enforced.
This administration has one of the narrowest strike zones we've ever seen.
U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services declined to comment on Magdoom's case. After Magdoom's initial application, the government requested further evidence. But the band was undaunted by the setback.
It only fueled them to work harder and show the government that they really are very serious about being musicians.
USCIS wasn't their only skeptic. Co-founding band member Evan Papier has gotten used to people asking whether Boythrob is a real band or an internet gag.
Two things can be true. We can be having fun and doing something different, but also pursuing artists in this music industry.
Evidence that they are real include four singles and a handful of sold-out shows.
Hello, everyone.
At a concert in New York, Magdoom joined over Zoom, despite the time zone difference. The crowd chanted the word visa to show their love. Most of these fans found the band on TikTok, where they've amassed 1.3 million followers in less than 10 months. Anthony Key says they've pulled this off by playing the social media game.
All of a sudden you see, you know, four guys in hot pink tracksuits. You're going to swipe back and you're going to be like, wait, what was that?
Obviously, I was captivated, enchanted, some would say.
One person who fell for the throb, pop superstar Kesha.
As someone who's kind of built a career on riding the line between seriousness and play, you know, game respects game. And of course, if you know anything about Kesha Records over here, we love pink.
She collaborated with Boythrob on their recent single, DJ Turn It Down, which was released on her record label. DJ Turn It
Down. First time I got to know we are collabing with the Kesha, I was like, is this real?
The big name collaboration came just in time for Magdoom and Boythrob. They were able to include this track in their official response to the government's request for further evidence.
That really helped us, like everything. The tour, the collab with Kesha, everything.
And on Monday, the band made a big announcement.
I got the visa!
Oh my God!
Now that Magdoom has his O-1B visa, he plans to move to the U.S. in October. He will finally get to meet his bandmates and his devoted fans.
I'm just like so excited for everything. I just want to meet every single person.
He's also looking forward to touring with the band and finally hitting those high notes in person. Theo Guerin, NPR News. Congrats, Boythrob! You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, an all-in-one business management platform with the goal of bringing every part of business together. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com/NPR. From the Andrew Carnegie Foundation, formerly Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. This is NPR.
Coming up another hour ahead of All Things Considered from National Public Radio. We receive support from AW Research Laboratories located in Brainerd, providing water testing for private wells, real estate, lakes, and wastewater since 1972. Online at awlab.com. Weather around northern Minnesota tonight, it's looking mostly clear with lows 50 to 54 degrees, northwest winds 5 to 15. Sunny tomorrow, highs in the mid-70s to low 80s with west winds gusting up to 20. Overnight lows in the low 50s to low 60s with a chance of showers and thunderstorms. And mostly sunny on Sunday with highs 75 to 82 and a slight chance of rain. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. People-powered radio since 1976. I'm Heidi Holton, and it's 5 o'clock.